Iranian politics and history are both complicated topics. The recent protests has the eyes of the world watching, but to understand what is really going on there, one needs to understand some of the background. If you want to know more on this, I'd recommend Kenneth M. Pollock's The Persian Puzzle, which is one of the sources I'm using for this video. The first thing to grasp is Iran's social structure. Much like many other nations, Iran had an aristocratic class and a long history of kings, or in Farsi, shahs. There was also a much larger peasant class, but to this we can add a number of special interest groups. First, there is the clergy, specifically proponents of Shia Islam, who have been a powerful and influential group in Iranian society and culture for centuries. The Iranians call them mullahs. Next, the bazaaris, the merchant class, who go back to the days of the Silk Road and who are an important voting bloc any government needs to think hard about getting on side. Then, of course, there are the intellectuals, many of whom, for the past 100 years or so, are similar to those in other countries, generally left-leaning, open to other cultures, and socialist in their economic views. The interactions of these factions is key to understanding Iranian history. For example, in 1890, the King of Persia, Nasiruddin Shah of the Qajar dynasty, granted a concession to Major Gerald Talbot, a British man, for a monopoly on all the tobacco sold in Persia. If Donald Trump thinks Obama's Iran deal was bad, what would he make of that one? This led to the establishment of the Imperial Tobacco Corporation. The headquarters was built in the city of Shiraz, which had to that date been the centre of the Iranian tobacco trade. Because you see, Iranians then, as now, liked a bit of a smoke. Now, as with any artificial government intervention in markets, this deal cut by Nasiruddin Shah ended up having terrible consequences. Of course, the government-mandated monopoly led to a sharp increase in prices for the end customer, lower prices for tobacco farmers who now had only one customer, and a lower cut of the profits for the merchants who sold the end product. This essentially ended up pissing everybody off. The bazaaris were naturally livid because a huge revenue stream for them was more than halved. Any smokers among the peasants were now being priced out of their favourite habit. And so it wasn't long before Ali Akbar Falsari, a firebrand mullah, issued this. It's a fatwa. Clergy effectively declared jihad on the Imperial Tobacco Company. This was quickly supported by the intellectual class, who naturally had influence in institutions like schools and universities and in the media. And so it quickly led to a national revolt against the Shah's deal. The fatwa effectively banned tobacco in Iran in a nationwide boycott until the Shah cancelled his concession to Gerald Talbot and the Imperial Tobacco Corporation, although he had to give them a £500,000 payoff for violating the terms of the contract, and at a time when his government was deeply in debt. Adjusted for inflation in today's money, that's about £60 million or $81 million. How's that for the art of the deal? Ultimately, this led to the Shah being assassinated in 1906, after which there were some democratic reforms to give the people more of a voice. There was a new constitution, which established the Iranian parliament known as the Majils. And this episode formed what was to be a long-lasting alliance between the four key social groups in Iran: the mullahs, the bazaaris, the intellectuals, and the peasantry. And it also has what is a very familiar theme in recent Iranian history: these four groups uniting against foreign interference in the economic affairs of the country. The mullahs, because they wanted to maintain the essentially Islamic character of the culture; the bazaaris, because they were being squeezed by outside competition, as well as screwed over by the awful deals that the Shahs were making under the duress of imperial threats, which at this time was the British and the Russians; the intellectuals, because of course they could see the exploitative nature of Iran's relationships with these foreign powers; and the peasantry, because some of these deals were making their already hard lives even harder, as well as the fact that the lower orders almost always swing nationalist or populist. If we fast forward to 1953, we have another Shah, Mohammad Reza Shah, aka the last Shah, and at that time, he was quite a young chap. And another basically imperial corporation built around a key resource. But this time, it wasn't tobacco, it was oil. And the corporation was the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, who had secured a one-sided concession similar to the Imperial Tobacco Corporation 50 years previously. Incidentally, my own grandfather worked for them, and in his memoirs, it is clear that its practices were fundamentally exploitative. Most Iranians in the 1940s felt that the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company was fleecing the nation's wealth and treating the natives as second-class citizens, even in violation of its labour laws, paying them low, near subsistence wages, around 50 cents a day, or $5 in today's money. To give you an idea of the reality of this situation, total Iranian oil revenues in 1950 amounted to £275 million. But of this, Iran itself only received £37 million, and this was largely because of a concession signed by Reza Shah in 1933. This is hardly the free market at play. It is collusion between a foreign company and a national government to produce monopoly conditions artificially. The Shah had become increasingly militaristic and maintained his power mainly because of his tight grip on the armed forces. Both the Shah and his father essentially forced Iran to modernize, pushing it through the Industrial Revolution and importing Western-style liberal cultural values at the expense of Shia Islamic ones. But the changes were not organic. Rather, as in the USSR, they were pushed through political power. In the terms of why nations fail, the structure under the Shah was essentially extractive. He was selling out a key resource, in this case oil, to maintain his own power and to pay off key factions, especially the army. The Shah had started meddling more in the democratic elections of the Majils. In 1947, he was exposed in rigging an election to install his own puppet prime minister. In 1949, there was a failed attempt to assassinate him by persons unknown. After this, a new political party formed called the National Front. Its leader was Mohammad Mossadegh. They campaigned on largely two issues, limiting the increasingly overbearing power of the Shah and curbing British appropriation of the nation's key resource, namely oil. They were enormously popular, uniting the mullahs, the bazaaris, the intellectuals and the peasants. By any standards, this was a very broad coalition, uniting socialists, capitalists and what some might think of as right-wing extremists. Mossadegh was duly elected on a radical agenda, which included nationalising Iran's oil reserves and expelling the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company. And here we get a perfect storm. Britain, in the 1950s after the war and during the spending spree of a certain Clement Attlee, was £1 billion in debt. The Anglo-Iranian Oil Company's annual tax revenues were to the tune of £142 million. And so for them, it was imperative that this nationalisation plan should be stopped. Meanwhile, the United States was in the middle of the Cold War and feared that Mossadegh's plans would lead Iran to becoming socialist and therefore flipping red to the USSR. In 1950, Aramco, the conglomerate of American oil firms operating in Saudi Arabia, managed to strike a 50-50 profit share deal with the Saudis, which gave many people the idea that a similar deal might be struck in Iran. But the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, and perhaps more importantly, the British government, could not afford this outcome because they were spending so lavishly on welfare schemes and things like the NHS at home. The British government drew up plans to send in 70,000 military troops. Meanwhile, the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company shut down the oil fields, fired all of its Iranian employees, about 20,000 of them in all, and convinced all the other oil firms in the world not to operate in Iran, effectively an embargo. The extra oil from the Saudi deal produced a glut of oil worldwide, which helped keep this embargo in place. In other words, the Iranian oil was not missed. The British government froze all Iranian assets in British banks and prohibited exports of key resources such as sugar or steel to Iran. And this at a time, of course, when the government had a monopoly on the steel industry, which was actually losing money. They also took the issue to the United Nations, declaring that the nationalisation of oil was illegal, and they tried to get sanctions put against Iran for doing so. Ultimately, the British convinced President Truman to intervene, and the CIA backed a coup against Mossadegh in 1953, removing him from office, which of course strengthened the position of the Shah and got the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company what it wanted. If you want to understand why the Iranian Revolution happened in 1979, all of the information is in this. The Iranians never forgot America's complicity, and much of the rhetoric about the Great Satan USA stems from this incident. And it was the same coalition of the mullahs, the bazaaris, the intellectuals and the peasants who united to overthrow the Shah once and for all. As you can see from these images, the crowds were not made up of religious fanatics in the main. It was a very broad coalition, the same one that had brought down the Shah in 1906, and the same one which had elected Mossadegh in 1953. Here you can see Khomeini with the first Prime Minister of the new Islamic Republic of Iran, Mehdi Barzagan, who was not a cleric or even a particularly religious figure. He was an intellectual with dreams of liberalizing the country. Khomeini repeatedly claimed he would retire to the mountains to contemplate the scriptures after the revolution. In 1978 he said, "Personal desire, age and my health do not allow me personally to have a role in running the country after the fall of the current system." In 1979 he said, "After the Shah's departure from Iran, I will not become a president or accept any other leadership role. Just like before, I will limit my activities only to guiding and directing the people." Of course, he was lying. He was lying quite a lot. And it is not difficult to see that this alliance between the mullahs and the intellectuals could not last. Barzagan wouldn't even last a year. He resigned in 1979 in response to the US hostage crisis. Khomeini was much more radical than any of them had thought. He didn't just want Iran to become an Islamic theocracy, he wanted to spread Shia Islam globally. He came to think that politicians could not be trusted to be truly Islamic on their own, and so clerics needed to be in special roles in order to guide them, and I'm sure that guidance will be truly benevolent. Now, in the interest of time, I need to skip over the Iran-Iraq War, but I have made quite an in-depth video on this in the past. I will link it in the show notes. If you're interested, you can stop this here, watch that, and then come back. And so we get the almighty mess that is Iran's current political structure, which is akin to navigating a labyrinth. The Majils, which, as I mentioned, were established in 1906, are maintained along with the old role of the Prime Minister, although that was abolished in 1989. But above the Majils, much like in the American system, there is a democratically elected president who effectively replaced the old Shah as the head of state. And, much like in the American system, there is also an upper and a lower house. The Majils is the lower house, and the upper house, akin to the Senate, is called the Assembly of Experts. And these are elected too. So far, so good, right? However, the Assembly of Experts, between them, elect a supreme leader. This is technically someone who is there for spiritual guidance. He has no official functions, no wage, no official office. He's just a kind of wise man who gives counsel. Only, he also appoints 6 members of the Guardian Council, who are sort of like the Jedi Council, only made up of radical mullahs. And this Guardian Council gets a final rubber stamp on all of the bills to come through the Majils. Oh, and they also get to approve or reject any given candidate from running in the first place. The other 6 members of this Guardian Council are supposed to be laypeople nominated by the judiciary, but these are rubber stamped by the Majils and the president himself. But in both cases, those people and their decisions have to be rubber stamped by the Guardian Council in the first place. And just in case all of this gets too messy, and let's say the Majils and the Guardian Council get locked in a conflict over some law or other, the Supreme Leader also appoints a special chamber called the Expediency Council, which is meant to mediate disputes between the two. I wonder how those rulings tend to go. I wonder if the Majils win out or the Guardian Council win out. Anyway, the Supreme Leader also controls the army. Oh, and the Revolutionary Guard, which is essentially a parallel army akin to the SS, who are more loyal to the regime. Oh, and he's also the head of the radio and the television, which are both state-run. So what is this holy hot mess of things that look like checks and balances, but which actually just give the supreme leader supreme power? What has all this actually led to? Well, for one, it has led to an insane amount of factionalism among competing political figures who mostly all happen to be mullahs. Second, it has led to the clerical class effectively replacing the old aristocracy across all aspects of society and culture. Endemic corruption stymies business because people are not promoted on merit but on their religious faith, and increasingly because their father or uncle is a powerful mullah. Finally, and most importantly, it has led to the utter waste of the nation's wealth. During the time of President Ahmadinejad, that's 2005 to 2013, Iran's oil revenues amounted to $800 billion in 8 years, which is more than the sum total of the previous 100 years of income combined. What happened to all that money? It certainly did not find its way into the pockets of ordinary Iranians. Various lavish public spending plans seemingly came to nothing. So recently, when his successor, President Rouhani, released the Iranian budget for normal people to see, there was widespread outrage which have led to the public protest that we are seeing now. None of the huge apparatus that supports the supreme leader is documented in these budgets, and yet there are holes in the public finances to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars. On top of that, the regime spends lavishly on its utopian ideas of spreading Shia Islam around the world. It spent between $15 and $20 billion on Syria alone last year, for example. It gives a huge amount of money to groups like Hezbollah and Hamas, while normal Iranians suffer. They also have a huge amount of non-taxable pyramid organizations under each Ayatollah, whose budgets run in the several billions, but whose figures do not show up in official records. The Revolutionary Guard are also involved in countless economic activities: oil, gas, steel, road construction, dam construction, you name it, and yet the budgets for any of these things are tax-exempt and do not show up in official numbers. This is a shadow economy hidden under the official economy, and in many ways they are far outside of President Rouhani's control. What we are seeing is general anger at the whole thing from the people on the streets. What happens next is anyone's guess. I would not count on the mullahs giving up their power very easily. And even if the army decides not to intervene against a popular rebellion, the Revolutionary Guard is 125,000 strong. We could even have the disastrous scenario of the official army and the Revolutionary Guard turning on each other. Even if this leads to the overthrow of the regime, I would not bet on the nation at large suddenly embracing its old Western friends. From their point of view, Britain and America behaved disgracefully in 1953, and before that, Britain had a good 100-year run of screwing over their nation. If it is to open up to foreign investment again, it will need to root out endemic corruption at all levels, establish strong and inclusive institutions, and the foreign investors, who provide some of that capital, will need to divest themselves of any neo-imperial dreams of wealth extraction. I am watching it all with interest. I'd like to thank Cult of the Lich, Son of Tiamat, Charles Vincent, and Edward Darrow. Till next time.